Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to episode 25 of The Hi-Lo, the weekly news and pop culture podcast brought to you by journalists Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton.
And a very special guest this week. Guess who's back? Back again. Davey's back. Tell a friend. Anyone who listened to Pandolly, which was sort of our maiden name of this podcast.
It was our trial podcast before the meat of The Hi-Lo.
But we did it for about 6 months. And our producer was a little man called David Maguire.
Little.
I didn't mean little man. I don't know why I said that. What have you been up to, Dave?
Grown a beard.
He's grown a beard. He's got married. What else has happened?
He's turned into a man.
Last time Dave was recording with us, it was the Pandolly Christmas special, of which we're going to insert a clip now. You'll probably be able to hear that between us we drank about 5 bottles of Prosecco. Thank you so much to Dave. Say hi, Dave.
Hello.
We couldn't have done it without Dave. We're not going to get emotional.
I feel emotional about it, though, Dave.
No, but we couldn't have
You've
done it without
You've been the
Dave.
Backbone of this whole thing.
We couldn't have done it without the Sunday Times, River Island and Dave. The
it's
ultimate triumvirate.
It's been a pleasure and an honour.
Who's your favourite out of the two of us?
Oh, Dolly. I've just compilation. Compilation, Dave. Cue the compilation. Thank you for everyone that listened to my Dolly. Over and out. We will miss you.
Anyway, it's lovely to have you back, Dave. I'm sure Charlie's listening, very concerned that he's been replaced.
Just for anyone who wonders, DJ CJ is cheating on us with another podcast.
Gardening.
For a little bit. Is it a gardening?
He's always cheating on us with gardening podcasts, and he brings in these award-winning marrows.
Yeah. He brought us a cucumber once. Yeah. That sounds really creepy. Anyway, so yeah, you got a little bit of Dave. He'll be dipping in and out of the Hi-Lo.
So, Pandora, jet setter, tell us where you've been.
Sound like about 65. I got back from New York last night. I was there for New York Fashion Week. I ate like a queen, but my God, New York is expensive for food.
Can I ask one thing that made me laugh so much? You put an Instagram post up of a skirt that had fanned out on a bench behind you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the most unflattering picture ever. There's not even any food in that picture.
I was so obsessed with this picture, but you also wrote a really funny caption. What did you say?
Something about my arse eating the bench. Because it literally, I know, it really does extend. So I ate all the food.
Where did you eat?
I went to Freeman's, your favourite, and had the artichoke dip. But you didn't tell me it's literally like a cheese souffle
it's
with an entire
cheese.
Loaf of bread.
It's cheese with artichoke dip.
I went to the Waverley Inn, which I love. It's quite a trendy spot, Waverley Inn. But it's just actually really nice and low-key and had amazing food. I can't remember what I ate, but I remember I really, really liked it. Where else did I go? I went to Cafe Clover, my fave.
Oh, never been there.
Went to the Butcher's Daughter.
Love it there.
Did love it the first time. Had some really odd bean bacon. It's vegan, so everything is not as it seems. Had some really odd bean bacon. Also, in America, the avocado toast, any Americans listening, please take note, they don't toast the toast properly, and the avocados aren't cold.
Ooh,
so
no.
It's quite bready and warm.
Ooh, I don't like that.
But I was honestly spending about $30 to $40 on every meal.
It's insane
it's
expensive
insane.
To
And
eat
whenever
in
you
York.
Say, God, it's expensive, everyone's like, what? You know, you're from
yeah,
London.
No,
and you're
it's
like,
mad.
But food does not cost this. I spent $10 on a smoothie.
Yeah, everything's more expensive in New York. I remember I posted when I was doing my awful, dreaded...
And forget about fucking tax.
I know.
Add it on afterwards. I forgot about room tax when I booked the hotel.
I know. And
sorry,
the bloody 50 quid tips you have to give the waitresses. No, they
deserve 20%.
It. But I remember when I was doing my dreaded flat hunt, which was a white-knuckle emotional ride, if you remember.
Yeah,
I was just
I do
ringing
remember.
You and crying all the time. And I found a flat that was... The size, it looked like a kind of dungeon, and it was the size probably of this, of the Acast's lovely studio. And I put it on Twitter and I said, this is a flat in London that costs £1,200 a month to rent. And Corinne Fisher, who's a New Yorker, who hosts Guys We Fucked, replied saying, honestly, I think that's really cheap. I think that's a real bargain.
Yeah, I mean, it's
mental. How much more expensive it is.
It is
in
mental.
New York.
For example, I was talking to a friend who has health insurance because obviously they don't have an NHS there. They have the soon to be dismantled Obamacare. Mm. And she pays $1,200 in healthcare a month.
Jesus.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are perks to living in London. But no, I did love being there, and I walked absolutely everywhere. I reached my compede record.
How many?
Entire packet on 2 feet.
Oh, compede. Sorry, I thought you meant like the steps record.
I did think you were fucking excited.
I thought you were saying that's your own personal measuring system.
No, my record, Ollie and I walked for... So I took most of Saturday off from the shows to spend with Ollie, and we walked for 6 miles that day.
Oh, that's great. How many steps is that?
I don't know. I don't look at my steponometer.
Because I always find my steponometer is always highest when I'm in New York.
Yeah, I walk a lot more... Actually, I walk quite a lot in London as well, but I walk a lot when I go to other cities. Same with Paris, I always walk a lot.
But did you have fun?
Yeah, it was good. I was really lucky that Ollie was also working there. So I think if I could take him on every work trip, the anxiety levels would just be so diminished. It's so nice knowing...
Can I take him on my work trips?
You can absolutely take him on your work trips.
We've already discussed, your husband and I have already been WhatsApping about how we want to take a holiday together.
Well, he calls it a dollar-day.
Only because I said on the podcast that I like going on holidays and doing nothing.
And he got really excited.
He got really excited. He's like, when people are like, let's go see some ruins. And I'm like, nah, bruv, let's just...
I know. Just he screenshots me your chats. So I know what's going on. And I finished the girlfriend experience, which we talked about on the last episode of The Hilo. It stars Riley Keough, and it is about escorting a law student. How far did you get? Have you got through
I only
it?
Got one ep in, but...
My God, it gets... Really,
a listener emailed us to say, do stick with it because it's different to Secret Diary of a Cool Girl in that it really does show the kind of the much darker, raw realities of
so
this
I
stuff.
Said in the last episode that I hadn't really seen much of an emotional arc, for a better word, with the protagonist played by Riley. And oh my God, I literally could hardly watch those last few episodes. There is, I think it's episode 9 of 13, where essentially a jealous ex-client emails a tape of them having sex from her email address to her whole law firm. And she goes into shock and she refuses to leave. So everyone's going, do you want to go home? Can you go home? She's going, no, why would I go home? And you watch her kind of breaking down, but it's brilliantly acted, breaking down, but whilst this glacial edifice from the outside, and eventually she has this panic attack, and I was sobbing. I mean, I sob quite a lot when I watch stuff at the moment, but I was sobbing watching this episode. I don't think I've ever watched or recently watched such an account. I mean, it was proper John Ronson public shaming, and it was utterly agonising to watch. I will lend you my login and watch the rest. They're only about 26 minutes long each one, but yeah, my God, it was really, really affecting. And something else that was really affecting, which I actually brought with me for you, Dol, is a piece in The New Yorker on a Muslim cop in the NYPD called Bobby Hadid, who lost his job due to suspicion over Muslim policemen, essentially. There was a lot of investigation going on, and the great thing about The New Yorker is like it's such, you know, it's sort of a 10,000 or 15,000 word long read, so you really get into the heart of the story. And it traces him from being an immigrant in New York, joining the NYPD in the aftermath of 9/11, like a lot of Muslim policemen who wanted to fight, you know, the discordant part of their religion that they were so against. And it follows this kind of rapid ascendance that he made in the NYPD and then plummet due to suspicion. Okay, so I'll just read you a little excerpt. In the years after the World Trade Center attacks, Muslim officers found themselves promoted to prestigious units because of their linguistic and cultural knowledge. A 2005 article in the Wall Street Journal announced that the NYPD was reaching out to immigrants who want to take Islam back from terrorist groups, but their newly elevated status could also make them look like interlopers. In a 2008 lawsuit, a Muslim Egyptian officer in the intelligence division's cyber unit complained that his colleagues told him that Muslims had no place in law enforcement. A Muslim officer from Pakistan who worked in the demographics unit in 2005 told me that after he expressed doubts about the purpose of eavesdropping on mundane conversations between Muslims, he was transferred. And it just goes on and on, and it's just a really brilliant piece. So I've got that for you, and I've also ripped out for you, which you'll probably be less interested to read, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Okay. A pop culture profile on Paris Hilton in Marie Claire. And the cover line on the magazine was, whatever happened to Paris Hilton? So I was like, okay, I'll buy that. And it's really, really interesting. She's sort of, you know, not talked about anymore in the same breath as Kim Kardashian, but she's got 25 fragrances, which bring in $3 billion globally, and she's the highest paid female DJ in the world. And she travels.
Who's buying those fragrances?
I actually don't know, but she's got two hotels. She just opened her second in the Philippines. She travels for 250 days a year. It's a really interesting pop culture profile. And I was actually really pleasantly surprised because I bought $50 worth of magazines in the airport yesterday. And I'm often not wildly impressed by American magazines, aside from New York Magazine and The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And I got like a really good bunch of glossies. So I've ripped that out for you as well.
I think she has got this self-awareness that is becoming more apparent.
You'll love reading this. She talks all about the cultivation of that baby voice and then how she shed that baby voice. She's now got a much huskier voice from smoking, and she says she like much prefers it.
Yeah. She said, she tweeted the other day and I retweeted it. She was like, in my house, I have a portrait of myself made up of hundreds of thousands of tiny pictures of me.
Yes, it's amazing. I saw that retweeted. And I also read, I tried to talk about it on last week's podcast, but we had to cut it out because I got the entire title wrong. I read a book by Lindsay Lee Johnson called The Most Dangerous Place on Earth, which is a really like brilliantly written buildings roman, essentially, which is a book that follows a character or characters growing up. And it's set in a high school. And if you like any kind of teen or YA fiction, but written, you know, really beautifully, it's an absolutely brilliant book. So that's everything I've been up to, and I'm really excited to begin the second series of Dr. Foster as well.
Oh, everyone's talking about
talking about it, except Dolly. I bet you won't watch that.
Do you know, I've lived in my flat now for over 2 months. I haven't even plugged my TV in.
You can watch it online though. You don't need a TV.
I know, I just
anymore.
Like showing off about that. I've been too busy reading books. No, I haven't actually.
You definitely haven't. What about you? Give me an update. Oh, God, on your storage issue.
So thank you so much to all the listeners who tweeted in some advice on my storage issue.
Thank you for not tweeting me as requested about Dolly's storage issue.
Fixed it in one fell swoop. Someone said what you should do is you should delete your mail, your inbox application, and then reload it. Because what happens is, over the years, all the attachments that you have save onto your phone.
Oh.
But there's no place that shows.
Do you know what?
It's
That's quite a handy hint
it's
for our
such
listeners.
A handy hint, because then it like resets it when you re-download your mail. And now I've got all this space.
Great. Job well done.
I've got the Sonos. I've got the eBay. I've got the Uber. We're all very excited.
Uber.
So I've just been reading some really good journalism this week. The first piece I wanted to flag up is one that it was on the Spectator blog that Fraser Nelson tweeted. Did you read it?
No, I haven't yet. I've bookmarked it. I've got loads of things to read now I'm back. I've bookmarked it to read.
It's lovely. So the Spectator have, and I really applaud them for this, they have to avoid kind of the nepotistic structure of journalism. I mean, I can't believe the Spectator of all places are the ones that are spearheading this. But they've decided with their internships that there's a no CV policy. So it means that the people who are most deserving are the people who get these kind of first foot in the doors. And what they didn't realise is that a woman who applied was a 42-year-old, I think, mother of three.
I think she was 48.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, I think 48-year-old mother of three.
It's a first-person piece that she wrote about why she re-entered the workplace, why she kind of started again in a new field, what it was like to re-enter after a period of being a mother at home. And it's just a really uplifting read, and it really proposes a lot of questions and thoughts about, as we move forward and the retirement age will get higher and higher and perhaps even dissolve at some point in the future, and how humans live longer, how we deal with people's, the longevity of people's working life, and how we deal with people's age in the workplace.
It's all kind of feeding towards this idea that we need to have more of a pro-aging attitude in society.
Exactly.
Because we just haven't evolved culturally to catch up with the fact that people are living much longer, and therefore they're working much longer.
And I did this piece in the Sunday Times Style a couple of weeks ago where I interviewed these two women who run a magazine called Advantages of Age, which is about age positivity. And something that they said is there will be, I can't remember the stat offhand, but they said in the future there will be a period in the not so distant future where there will be more elderly people than there will be children. And she said, what we're not addressing is, what are these people going to do? What are they going to do? What are they going to think? What are they going to, what are their communities going to be? How are they going to spend their time? How do we make use of them? So, yeah, it was just a really uplifting piece. And I just really applaud The Spectator for putting a structure in place that means a woman like this, who would definitely have been overseen, I think, can thrive.
Great. We'll tweet that out and we'll put that in the bio notes to this episode.
I'm sorry about my arsey tweet, by the way. Did you see that?
I know it drives you mad when people say, where can we find that thing you mentioned? Just to reiterate, if you follow the Hilo Show, at the Hilo Show on Twitter, I, every single week, write out a list of what we're reading, what we're watching, and they all go in the episode notes on the bio to this. So if you're listening through Acast or SoundCloud or iTunes, just click to see the synopsis of the episode and all the links are in there.
It's not hard, lads.
And if you do email and ask, the chances are we're not going to reply with that specific link because that's a full-time
job. I
do
actually reply.
Do you?
I do, yeah.
Okay,
with a passive-aggressive one kiss. And if you're nice to me, you get two. I've also read this really, really brilliant and useful piece by a journalist called Hannah Ewens, I think is how you say her surname, who's a very good Vice journalist. And it's quite a hefty read. And it's about everything you might want to know about therapy before you start therapy or while you're in therapy, as she's someone who's been in therapy for 10 years. And it's kind of, it's very honest. It's a list of all the things that you might not expect, both practical, emotional, how it will affect you internally, how it will affect...
Did you find yourself agreeing with it?
Yeah, it was the most... I've been in therapy for a year and a half, and it was the most accurate description of what... Obviously, she says in it, this is not going to be everyone's experience, and she doesn't claim to know specifics about certain mental health issues and, you know, certain specific problems being solved in certain types of therapy. But in terms of going to speak to a professional every week and what that relationship is and how it will affect your relationships out in the real world and your relationship with yourself, I found it unbelievably accurate, useful, honest and brilliant. And
cool, I'll read that.
Yeah, because, and also, you know, it can be a very expensive, very overwhelming, sometimes if you're doing it on the NHS, very difficult thing to start in the first place. So I think it will be useful for anyone considering it, or indeed anyone who's in it now. I also read a piece in the Sunday Times magazine. God, it was such a good magazine this week, with Nigella Lawson.
I've got that, I think, oh, hello, there she is.
There she is.
Does she talk about Charles Saatchi?
No, she doesn't. It's
Damn.
All about her new book. I mean, look at that
I want
cover.
To know. I know, she's phenomenal looking.
I think she's one of the greatest beauties of
I
our time.
I hope she'd be on, like, I hope she'd talk about that because I still think it's this really riveting.
I know. No, she doesn't. It's just about her new book. But, you know, you forget with Nigella Lawson that she hammers home over and over again in this piece. She's like, I'm not a chef. I'm just a cook. She's a very brilliant cook. But you forget that she was a Sunday Times journalist. You know,
she was married to John Diamond.
Yeah,
before.
Yeah. And she's just, and you really, it shines through in this piece what a beautiful writer she is. First and foremost, she's just the most beautiful writer.
Is it a first person piece?
It's a first person piece about being a home cook. And then it's got some really good recipes as well. But there's just this one bit that meant so much to me when I read it that I think... Where is it? Here it is. The currency of a recipe always seems such an extraordinary thing to me. Taste is so personal. It's a wonder any two of us can cook the same thing and like it equally. Yet a recipe remains such a happy means of communication. In writing my new book, At My Table, I have reflected long and deep on what the recipe is and what it means. As I've said before, but feel no less intensely now, a recipe is a highly charged autobiographical form. A recipe tells a story, is a container of memories.
You think that hugely, don't you?
I really do. And I just...
Am I allowed to give a spoiler alert about recipes?
Yeah.
Being in your book?
Yeah, recipes are in my book. And for someone, I think for a lot of us, food is the real marker of moments in our life. You know, the day, your first date with someone, or what you ate after a funeral when you were sad, what you ate on your wedding day. I just think she just captured really beautifully what that means and how it kind of connects
us to people. The emotional context.
Yeah. Chrissy Teigen is in London Pandora as well, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, I know, because I told you to get on her timeline.
Did you see I tweeted her saying, if you come on our podcast, I will make you the most delicious pasta, because I know she loves carbs.
Are you really loving that she's discovering British telly?
Yeah, she's just sitting in a hotel room with her baby watching British TV with these unbelievably effusive tweets. I'm just going to read some of them. She wrote... In love with Gogglebox. I don't think I can go to John's show tomorrow. I'll be watching Channel 4. And then she wrote, Celebs Go Dating, Celebrity Dating Agency. I'm never leaving the UK.
There's something called Naked Attraction on here in London. And what the F is this? It's dating based on genitals. Like, I'm seeing peepees.
And then she also tweeted going, oh my God, if I was eliminated first based on my genitals, I don't think I would ever get over that.
I just had a moment. And then she Instagrammed her and John and their little girl on in the kind of rainy square, I think, in Soho, saying, oh, it's our favourite weather. And then she Instagrammed that she was at the Ivy eating shepherd's pie. And I was like, London, do your fucking best to keep Chrissy Teigen here. Show her a good time. I need her to move here with John Legend, and then I need to become her best friend.
So for anyone who doesn't know who Chrissy Teigen is, she is a very funny woman and a model as well, who's married to the singer John Legend. And she has built up a real reputation for being just amazing on Twitter. She's very, very funny, particularly when someone says something that insults her. So someone tweeted, she had both of her children, a boy and a girl, through IVF. They had both of their children, a boy and a girl, through IVF. And someone tweeted being like, well, did you try and get pregnant naturally? And she replied being like, hey, Linda, yes, we tried for 10 years, you witch.
Yeah, she's great. And she's also just, she's very honest, and she's very, she's just really funny as well.
She's very funny.
I think my favourite tweet she ever did was someone was saying, someone said something really mean to her, like, who are you? Your life must be so depressing. And she said, I'm on Lake Como with the love of my life, eating pasta. I've got a best-selling book and I married rich.
Yeah, I like the way she talks a lot about being rich. Yeah, it's very, she's very honest as well.
Yeah.
It's great.
She's a breath of fresh air, and she is my best friend, even though she doesn't know it yet.
Support for the high-low comes from our sponsor, NARS. NARS have partnered with longtime collaborator Christopher Kane on a new collection. The Chrome Couture collection, featuring two new products, an iridescent lipstick and prismatic eyeshadow palette inspired by the designer's signature aesthetic. The collection will launch Monday, September the 18th, directly following the Christopher Kane show in London. It will only be available in the NARS Covent Garden boutique and narscosmetics.co.uk with limited quantities. NARS will be hosting a waiting list online via the link that we'll put in our show notes from the 14th of September. NARS is offering Hilo listeners two deluxe travel size freebies when they make a purchase online at narscosmetics.co.uk. How kind of them. Simply type in the code HILO, H-I-L-O-W, at the checkout and you'll receive a mini Audacious mascara and mini velvet matte lip pencil in Dolce Vita, one of their best-selling pinky nude shades.
Interesting accent you chose there. I'm going to do that this week because I need to top up on my custard concealer. So I'm going to go online as well to get my Dolce Vita
You have
lip
to do
liner.
The voice.
I stole it from Dolce Vita. I stole it from my friend Emily, and she texted me going, hey, you stole my Dolce Vita lip pencil. And I was like, it's really rather nice. And she did the Hilo promo.
Did she?
I was like, I must go onto the Hilo and do one. This is our last week with NARS. They have been a brilliant sponsor for the last 12 weeks. And we will continue to be a slave to your cosmetics. So this is the last week that you can enjoy the Hilo promo. So get shopping.
Thank you, NARS.
This is the top line. After being fired by L'Oreal, as discussed in last week's episode, for her comments made on Facebook about white privilege in the aftermath of the Charlottesville tragedy, trans activist and model Munro Bergdorf has been hired by British makeup brand Illamasqua. Just one in 50, only 2% of the UK's social housing tower blocks has a full sprinkler system, according to a new investigation released on the eve of the public inquiry into the Grenfell fire disaster. A Freedom of Information request also found that 68% of the council and housing association owned blocks have just one staircase with which to evacuate. Rihanna launched her beauty line, Fenty Beauty, last week with record-breaking sales. Available exclusively at Harvey Nichols in the UK, it did over £1 million worth of sales in the first week. Particularly popular are the darker shades of foundation, long absent from the cosmetics market due to the mistaken belief that they would not sell. Hurricane Irma evacuees are returning to Florida to find that one quarter of homes in Florida Keys have been destroyed. Nearly 6.9 million homes have been left without power. 18 people sadly died in the storm after the strongest storm in history, with winds of 185 miles per hour. In slightly paltry comparison, but nonetheless newsworthy, Storm Aileen has hit the UK with winds of 75 miles per hour, leaving 800 homes in Nottinghamshire without power. Cindy Crawford's daughter, Kaia Gerber, made her catwalk debut at Calvin Klein over New York Fashion Week. The nascent supermodel is only 16 years old, but is set to be the next Kendall Jenner. Australian actor Rebel Wilson has won $2.7 million in Australia's largest ever defamation payout. She claimed that 8 articles published by Bauer Magazines, Women's Day and Australian Women's Weekly in 2015 portrayed her as a serial liar and that this resulted in her being sacked from 2 films. Bauer claimed that the articles were both true and trivial with no lasting damage to her career, but a 6-woman jury rejected their arguments.
Wow.
Jim Carrey has given a bizarre interview at Venice Film Festival where he claims that we do not exist. The actor, a fan of transcendental meditation, said, "The fact is, you don't exist. You are nothing but ideas. We take those ideas and we cobble them together and we make a personality charm bracelet, which is an ID bracelet that we wear in life. But that's not who we are because we're nothing and it's a fucking relief." The humble wheelie bin may soon be no more with the arrival of an underground system. The modern subterranean refuse system has been trialled in West Cambridgeshire, doing away with 9,000 wheelie bins. You put your rubbish into a steel chute and a sensor notifies the council when it's full to come and pick it up. Underground bins are apparently used extensively across the rest of Europe. The council has warned that these are very, very deep. A floral tribute of Princess Diana in Chesterfield has been mocked online after the pictures were shared on Facebook by the City Council. Google it, please, to see the true monstrosity. The council said in its defence that it was made by 14 volunteers using the ancient art of well dressing. No, me neither. And that all art is meant to be a talking point anyway. And that was the top line.
Oh, God, poor old Jim Carrey. I feel like I've been Jim Carrey at a party occasionally.
What, and said we don't exist?
Just someone mouthing or someone who's
I wouldn't want to be in a small room or studio with you, drunk, talking about transcendental meditation.
I think, you know, when you've had an experience, he's obviously felt something or read something that's so poignant to him that you just... It's not the right red carpet chat, is it?
He's had a really odd 5 years, though. His ex-girlfriend sadly committed suicide. And her family, there were a lot of inquiries into that and how his behaviour might have impacted her very sad decision to end her life. I think he's had a really tough few years and I wonder whether he has looked to alternative meditations to try and deal with what he's gone through, and ultimately it's leaving him now saying some quite odd stuff at the Venice
Film Festival.
It's just
hard to communicate it, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just maybe best sort of on your own time to investigate that.
Great news about the bloody wheelie bins.
I know, can you believe it?
Do you have to do wheelie bins?
I cannot wait until I have wheelie bins. I just have a normal kitchen bin. So I have mounds of rubbish in my kitchen that the cat likes to get into.
Actually, it must be because you're on a high floor.
I have to keep them out on the windowsill and then close the window.
I just think it's Neanderthal, our bin system in this city. I really do. I really think a chute system is long overdue.
I think it's an amazing idea, a subterranean system.
It must cost a lot of money, though.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. But I would quite like to see my local council spend that on a subterranean refuse system rather than on baskets of flowers on lampposts.
Yes, I agree.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Female Silicon Valley CEO has admitted to dyeing her blonde hair brown in hopes that colleagues will take her more seriously. Eileen Carey, who runs a software company called Glassbreakers, explained that she stopped wearing high heels, swapped contact lenses for glasses, and started wearing gender-neutral clothing in a bid to appeal to investors. She told the BBC, "The first time I dyed my hair was actually due to advice I was given by a woman in venture capital." She went on to say that by dyeing her hair brown, she looked older than she was, and it also meant she would not be seen and characterised in a sexual way. What do you make of the story, my fellow blonde? Does it make you despair?
This isn't the first time I've heard a story of this ilk, but it's just really nuts. I don't really understand how in 2017 this is still a thing, and toning down your looks in order to be taken seriously just seems to be a really old chestnut that is somehow still purveying in some circs.
Yeah, I think this story is a great shame. I hate that women still feel they have to trick the world into somehow taking them seriously. Well, the corporate world. And that's what all these stories are saying fundamentally. I know a woman who used to put a wedding ring on, who she wasn't married, in meetings with men because she felt it made her be taken more seriously and she was listened to more attentively. And all these stories say to me is that women still feel that not only do they have to cover up who they are, but they have to pretend they're someone else entirely to have their voice heard. Have you ever pared down the way you look or altered your appearance so you'd be taken more seriously in the workplace?
I just suddenly had a mental image of you catching me out and about in like a navy suit and court shoes and like a butterfly clip bun and you being like, Panda, where are you off to? I'm just off to a meeting, Golly. I'll see you later. How old was the woman that wore put on a fake wedding ring?
Early 30s.
God. No, I haven't ever done that. And this is all such an anathema to me. I have never adjusted my appearance based on what I thought would make me appear more qualified at my job. I mean, sure, I make adjustments to my garb based on what the day holds, you know.
The context, yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't wear a see-through shirt to a job interview, and I wouldn't wear like my wackiest fashion garb to a panel event about feminism or my dad's 70th birthday. But I truly don't feel pressure from anyone looks-wise but myself. Actually, probably comes from within more than anything else. So I must be really lucky in that regard. What about you?
The only time I really consciously made an effort to look like someone else was my, bear with me here, very short-lived and disastrous venture into stand-up comedy and sketch comedy in my early 20s.
Oh, I wish there's footage of that.
Sadly not. And I did meet my ex-boyfriend there, so if you ever want true revenge on me, then he can give you an account of it. I did an open mic slot one night wearing my normal clothes, and I remember the man who followed me, who is a Canadian comedian, who is the headliner, spent the first 5 minutes of his set just making jokes about the fact he wanted to sleep with me. And I was really embarrassed. And I remember feeling like, how dare you? I just had a really good 5 minutes. And I was feeling really powerful. And I can't say anything back to you now. So you kind of have taken that power away from me. Anytime I was on stage after that, I did really consciously change the way that I dress. I would always wear really baggy men's shirts, plimsolls, jeans. I didn't wear any makeup. But now I don't think if I ever went back to comedy, and don't worry, I don't have any plans to ever do that in the future. But if I was doing that now, I don't think I would do that. In fact, as I get older, I think I really revel in sinking more into my personal style and allowing that to be a fairly unmalleable thing.
Sinking or slinking? I think you slink.
Slinking, maybe. Obviously, I take appropriateness into account and formality, as you said, but I never really change how I look or what I'm wearing in order to be taken more seriously at work. But then again, I think that's probably speaking from a place, both of us, of unusual freedom, as we both work in creative, fairly relaxed, fairly open-minded industries. And normally, most meetings I have are with women. I actually walked from my flat the other day to a voiceover record in Soho wearing my pyjamas, and no one batted an eyelid when I turned up.
That's because your pyjamas are striped leggings from Gap.
Yes, exactly.
And a Glossier sweatshirt, and they can absolutely masquerade as normal, if albeit sloppy daytime attire. I agree, I'm also extraordinarily lucky to work in a field where no one is ever going to make me feel like I have to tone it down. In fact, quite the opposite. I actually sometimes feel this pressure by dint of being primarily a fashion journalist that I have to look a certain way. You know, places and someone go, oh, what are you wearing? And sometimes I yearn actually not to have that pressure, but that's a very different pressure and it's not one with the same gravitas. It's certainly not me feeling like people are not going to take me seriously. Mm. Although out of, you know, a job situation, I have felt that. I have been at, in fact, I was at a spectator party and all of the much older male journalists just switched off instantly when someone said I wrote about fashion. So I still feel misogyny in different ways to the CEO of this story.
What annoys me most about this story, I think, is the gendered double standard we have when it comes to looks or style, personal style in the workplace. And we sort of touched on this a few episodes ago when we talked about President Macron's makeup habit at
so
French
weird.
Taxpayers'
I've
expense.
Heard that it's more than we said as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think Eva Wiseman tweeted and it was a higher figure than we had. Anyway.
So the report that I read was that he's spent €26,000 on makeup since May. And I remember in the wake of that story,
there was some criticism, but mainly people just found it hilarious for a couple of days. And then again, sorry to go back to the bloody leather trousers, but Theresa May buys one pair of 900 quid leather trousers with her own money nearly a year ago, and people are still talking about them as if they unlocked her true colours of being a bad leader and maybe even a bad person. Men in the workplace are allowed to be a great many things, and they're lauded as Renaissance men. They can be CEOs and fathers, CEOs and playboys. They can be CEOs and look absolutely gorgeous. And actually, all these other sides to who they are just make them even more interesting to us. Whereas women are allowed to be one thing when they're a CEO, and that's a CEO. And they have to prove they're serious. They have to prove they want it enough. They have to prove they're deserving. They have to not let anything else distract from the fact that they're a cardboard cutout CEO. And it must be incredibly tiring having to hide or apologise for parts of who you are in order to be taken seriously and given space.
So I agree with that to an extent. Definitely the idea that women are appraised on their looks and that they have to sort of shape shift and hide certain parts in order to be taken seriously. But I think I disagree with this woman, actually, because I was just thinking in my head, I was running through CEOs when you were saying that. And I was thinking of the CEO of Into the Gloss and Glossier, Emily Weiss. Gorgeous, stylish, absolutely never seems to dim down who she is. I was thinking of the CEO of Bumble, who was one of the co-founders of Tinder, Whitney Wolf. Again, blonde, glamorous, doesn't seem to be. I was thinking of Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook. I was thinking of Carmen Busquet. I can't ever pronounce her surname, but she's a venture capitalist who invested in Net-a-Porter, amongst other things, and she's hugely revered in the tech industry. Natalie Massenet, who was at Net-a-Porter. Again, these are largely fashion beauty, but there's, you know, there's some tech in there. And I read an article on Slate.com last year that I found very interesting. It said even though 5% of the US population have blonde hair, 35% of female US senators and 48% of female CEOs are blonde. So they're not all dyeing their hair brown, which I'm pleased to see.
I also want to make it clear that although I despair for this woman, and I do worry that by her giving this interview, she might be making this sort of altering of appearance for corporate approval commonplace. I also understand this is her daily reality and it is powerful for her to tell the truth. And I get why she does it in the first place. The Independent this week, off the back of this story, pointed out that only just last year, a survey found that 60% of women working in tech had experienced unwanted sexual advances. And even more recent research shows one in four women are cautioned about their appearance in the workplace.
Jesus.
Compared to a paltry 9% of men. And one of the things they're often warned about is either wearing too much makeup or wearing a skirt that's too short, as it might be a distraction. So this sort of misogynistic culture is coming from the top down, and it is really deeply systemically embedded in these industries, which means you have to really fight against a very strong current, I imagine, every time you get ready for work in the morning. So I do understand why one day you might just take off the makeup, dye your hair, and dress like a different person as a means to an end just to be able to get on with your job.
Well, that's a good point. And let's not forget that Whitney Wolf, the CEO of Bumble, sued her fellow co-founder of Tinder, Justin Mateen, who happened to be her ex-boyfriend, for sexual harassment. So here's to getting on with your job, whether you feel like wearing Gap leggings one day or four sparkly enamel bracelets the next.
Very nice.
The Hi-Lo is sponsored by Sainsbury's Home. Sainsbury's Home prides itself on delivering great quality, design-led products at very nice prices, aka high quality design at high street prices. Sainsbury's Home has a dedicated in-house design team of 14, and 80% of Sainsbury's Home product is designed by the in-house creative team. For autumn, the Sainsbury's Home team have taken inspiration from the great British countryside, from the interiors of inner-city boutique hotels and cocktail lounges. Authentic design is at the heart of how the 14 in-house designers create their exclusive prints and palettes, and this season each trend has a signature fragrance blended exclusively for Sainsbury's Home to evoke all the warmth and comfort and spice of winter. So the ranges available this September are Nordic Skies, inspired by the Nordic scenery
and lifestyle. This muted tone theme exudes contemporary style, embossed textures, and soft accenting of colours in materials such as wood, mercury, glass, and grey faux fur. Renaissance boutique indulge in the glamour and grandeur of the 1920s with stylish home accessories, geometric patterns, and opulent skilled craftsmanship. Then you have Woodland Walk, which captures the tones and textures of an autumnal country walk, creating cosy living space with warm aubergine and mulberry colours used across chunky knits and pattern textiles. The Sainsbury's in-house design team have created a unique narrative of a woodland scene with hair figures in rich brass metallic finish and an exclusive fragrance of applewood and clove. Enjoy all of those. There is something for everyone. Thank you very much to Sainsbury's Home.
Kate Winslet has come under fire for comments she made in an interview with The Independent about her upcoming role in a film directed by Woody Allen called Wonder Wheel. In the interview, when the journalist asks if the allegations of child molestation against Woody Allen made her think, she said, "Of course one thinks about it, but at the same time, I don't know Woody and I don't know anything about the family. As the actor in the film, you just have to step away and say, I don't know anything really, and I don't know whether any of it's true or false. Having thought it all through, you put it to one side and you just work with the person. Woody Allen is an incredible director, so is Roman Polanski. I had an extraordinary working experience with both of these men, and that's the truth." So for anyone unaware of the specifics of those allegations, in 1992, Woody Allen was accused of sexual abuse by his 7-year-old adopted daughter, Dylan Farrow, but no charges were brought against him. Roman Polanski pleaded guilty to statutory rape in 1978 when 13-year-old Samantha Geimer accused him of drugging her and sexually assaulting her. So what do you make of Kate's comments, Dolly? Do you think she was wrong to speak so ambiguously about this?
Yes, I do. But then again, I understand why she did, because what's she going to say about her director, that she believes he is a child molester? Then the question is, why is she working with him in the first place?
Well, that is the question.
Yeah. So really, the criticism isn't that she wouldn't answer questions about the allegations with any true conviction or clarity, but rather that she's an actor who's willing to put it to one side to work with a person.
So I really disagree with that, morally speaking. So, you know, oh, you just put it to one side and you work with the person. Do you? Why? But then I was thinking, we think that you have a lot of luxury of choice as a Hollywood actress. And of course, Kate Winslet does have the luxury of choice. But if you sort of translate that into another working environment, say me or you was working at a company and the CEO was known to be a creepy prick, would you necessarily leave the company based? So, for example, if you worked at Uber and the now fired Travis Kalanaki, the founder of Uber, was known to be a real creep. I know people who work at Uber. I wouldn't expect them to have quit just because the CEO was a creep. So that, yeah. So I initially thought, well, you don't put it to one side, Kate. What on earth are you talking about? Anyway, what do you think?
Well, I think the problem is Woody Allen, to a great many people, is one of the most talented and greatest artists of our time. He's revered. Some of his work is spectacularly seminal. It's influenced a great many other great auteurs. He famously has this very strange casting method with actors, which means you really do, I think she probably would have felt like she'd really been chosen by a deity. And when you're chosen for one of his characters, I'm sure for many actors, it feels like a real string to their bow. So no one wants to be the one who is the person who stops that force or somehow quashes the larger symbolism of what this man is and what his work means. But then who does? Who does decide whether we should be celebrating and giving more money and more power and more cultural significance to someone who's been accused of child molestation? And what message does it send out into the world when some of the most respected people in the film industry are saying, yeah, well, he might have done this really terrible thing, but he's just so good and he's so funny and he's so clever and he's Woody Allen. We're just going to put that to one side and make another film.
It's interesting how many people still engage with him, because, of course, it's not just Kate Winslet.
No, it's people,
it's a great,
like
Emma Stone,
yeah.
Who I really respect in many ways. I think, though, you know, essentially, he's not a deity. You haven't been chosen by a deity when you're in a Woody Allen film.
Exactly.
He's a human. And I find the whole artists get out of jail free card because they're an artist card really problematic, you know, sort of like, oh, they're racist, but they're an artist. Oh, they're paedophiles, but they're an artist. And you can go on and on with that. And it's fucking pretentious. Just because Roman Polanski and Woody Allen are incredibly renowned directors doesn't mean they can touch underage girls. And if you look again to translate this into other professions, if there was a tennis player that was known for touching up his physiotherapists or his trainers, he would not be in the Grand Slam. Something, you know, there would have been something that would have happened for that to have been quashed. And I think if you want to work in the films of these men with their dubious moral history, fine, work in them, because shitloads of people still are, but don't be wishy-washy. Speak up. Be on their side if you want. I just don't think you can have it both ways. You can't be a fierce defendant and proponent of young girls and women, a strident feminist, and then go all sort of vague and work in these films. Exactly. I just don't think that's ethically possible.
I agree. Daisy Buchanan wrote a really good piece on this very subject about where the buck lies. I'm just going to read from the last paragraph because I think it really hits on what we're saying. The continuing success of Allen and Polanski is depressing, exhausting proof of a problem we all share. Our society is set up in a way that we will always support men no matter what they've been accused of. Maybe the rest of us should speak up, do more, and refuse to work with them. But I'm exhausted. I'm willing to bet Winslet is too. When you've managed to forge a career in one of the most sexist industries there is, it must be hard to muster the energy to keep fighting battles against your employers. We can't expect the abused to take back power from their abusers. We need to point the finger at the investors, studios, and money men who silently, stealthily endorse this sexist standard with every check they write.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It always comes down to the bottom dollar. While there are people still making money, crucially for other people, those dudes will be fine.
Yeah.
And it's also worth noting that that doesn't mean that I don't understand why they are doing that. You know, Hollywood is a business. Like all industries, it's a business. It's very easy to sit on your moral throne and say, well, that's just preposterous. You shouldn't work with these people. We shouldn't do any of this. Shut it down immediately. But as you say, Woody Allen and Roman Polanski are revered directors that if they're attached to a film, they'll probably get funding. You know, they'll have the investor. Things will get greenlit. Actors will.
But the question is, who stops it? Who stops it?
Well, that's the thing. As Daisy Buchanan says, it's the money men, the investors and the studios. But what I'm saying is I disagree with, but understand why they are still...
happens.
Yeah, exactly.
In the past, I'll be completely honest, I've really struggled to get my head around the Woody Allen thing. And I know a lot of people won't like hearing that, but it's one of those subjects where when it came up, dinner conversations, I would feel really uncomfortable. Because in terms of his films and writing, he is one of my greatest inspirations. His work really feels embedded in the identity I was carving out for myself when I was very young. So as pathetic as it might sound, it is a very upsetting and confronting thing when you're told that that person might have done something so awful that no film, no short story, no interview will ever be good enough to override his actions, that those actions will then taint every part of that work that you loved and perhaps even every part of yourself that you decided you were off the back of that work. I know that sounds pretentious, but that's true. And I have really considered whether I can still enjoy all his work that I treasured when I was younger or support any of his current work now and where I stand on that. And then I listened to a What the Fuck episode with Lena Dunham, and she you know, feels the same as me about his earlier work, but she obviously, like me, believes Dylan Farrow. So she said this thing, of which we're going to embed an extract now, that I found very useful.
Bad people have done amazing things.
It's totally true.
And there's nothing.
And that doesn't mean I can acknowledge that. Well, I think one of the reasons that people have been so uncomfortable, people who really believe Woody Allen is guilty have not felt comfortable saying that because they're so afraid to lose their connection to his work. And the thing is, I feel like people need to understand that you can hold two positions in your mind. You can know that someone's made work that's meaningful to you and also know that they have most likely molested their daughter. And that's been an interesting thing. I've probably spoken about this way too much on Twitter just because it's so important to me that victims of sexual abuse speak out about it. But I was so unimpressed by people's inability to think in less binary ways and to just experience the ambiguity that life is constantly offering up.
That's a really excellent way of putting it, actually. It reminds me of a piece that I saw on Twitter that I'm yet to read, but I need to go back and find, by a black journalist. And it was along the lines of how to still love Gone with the Wind, which is largely thought of as racist, as a black feminist. And I think that really chimes with Lena's theory on holding these two positions. valuing someone's work that you find very meaningful, but also most likely knowing that they have molested their daughter.
Yeah. And the other thing I'd like to point out is that Lena Dunham was talking about, when she says not thinking in binary terms, she's talking in reference to people who consumed his work, not people who worked with him. And I do think you have to be more clear-cut in where you stand on the matter. If you're working with someone, you're in contact with them every day, you're making money with and for them. We're not talking about someone who's trying to work out whether they can still have an Annie Hall poster on their wall and also believe Dylan Farrow. We're talking about someone who is essentially going into business with him, which is why her answer didn't wash for me.
Yeah, agreed. I wrote a piece, I think it was earlier this year, on my website, pandorasykes.com, about how I feel like celebrities should be more vocal and verbal about their beliefs, whether political, moral, ethical, these days. I think we live in a time, you know, a post-truth world, where amongst the fake truths, we need transparency and honesty. I think that's culturally what people really expect and deserve. And I think if you're going to continue to operate within that pop culture media structure and earn the millions of bucks that you do, then you need to feel some responsibility for that. That's why I think there's a lot of backlash at the moment against Kendall Jenner. A lot of sort of marketing and PR top dogs have been talking about how the tides are really turning for the reality star and model. And a lot of it is because she is never coming out to explain her actions over anything. She's never just holding her hands up and saying, oh, I made a mistake, or this is why she did it. So she never said anything in the aftermath of that Pepsi advert that obviously got pulled immediately. She never came out and said anything about, she did a fist pump emoji, and a lot of people were very outraged. I happen to think this is a slightly OTT response, but people were outraged that the colour of her fist pump was darker skinned than her own, and they're accused of appropriation. Again, she just didn't say anything. And I think people are bored of people not saying anything. We just don't live in a culture where that goes anymore. So as you say, do it or don't do it, but be prepared to explain your decisions. And I mean, ultimately, Dolly, if you did something that I disagreed with morally and ethically, whilst it would be hard to leave these millions behind the high low makes, I just have to, Dolly. I just have
to. I'd be dumped. I know I would.
It's now time for Ask the High Low. Dolly, do you want to read out our listener question from this week?
Dear Dolly and Pandora, I would like to say thank you to the both of you. Thank you because I feel like I've found two new friends in listening to your podcast. I've been known to talk to myself, well, to you, in the street, on the train or at home, because I felt like I was having a chat with some girlfriends. Yes, I'm slightly bonkers. Radical change of topic, sex. I have a problem. I have no sex drive. And by none, I mean I can't remember the last time I wanted sex. I've been with my other half for a few years now, and I don't seem to want it. And we do try. I usually have a freak out and push him off. The thing is, the first year we were together, sex was awesome. One day, that was over. I'm terrified to go see the doctor about it. I've not told friends because I don't think this is a normal thing to go through. I love my boyfriend and I know he's not the problem, but what am I supposed to do to move forward? Our relationship is otherwise so good, and the sex, or lack thereof, is the only thing missing.
Sex, sex, sex. It's what makes the world go round.
That's useful.
I'm slightly nervous, in all honesty, I'm slightly nervous about saying too much on this, because the last time we spoke to a girl who hadn't ever wanted to have sex with anyone, and I know your situation is slightly different, and I said that asexuality is, you know, something
you
that exists.
You didn't just say that. You posed that this could be something.
Well, we had a few emails saying that it was wrong of me to suggest that this girl was asexual and it would have freaked her out. And all I was trying to do is cover the many different sexual positions, not literally, that people hold. You know, you could be a randy old bugger and like having sex every day. You could be someone that's very content with having sex once a month, every 6 months. You could be in a sexless marriage, but still very happy. What I would say is that often sex is that indicator, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, Dolly, that emotionally there are things that you're not happy with at a deeper level, subconsciously, that you can't see.
Yes.
So people often say that their relationship broke down when they stopped having sex, and it then emerged why they'd stopped having sex. They didn't realise at first, they just knew that they weren't motivated that way.
As Nora Ephron says, it's the symptom.
Well, there you go, and then you get to the root of the problem. But of course, I don't want to suggest there's anything wrong with your relationship if you're happy in it. It's difficult to know what advice to give specifically beyond, if it's making you miserable, then it is something you may want to talk to the doctor about. It is something you may want to talk to your partner about. Because also, kind of sexual impulses can be affected by loads of things.
Well, this is what I was going to say.
It can be affected by diet. It can be affected by stress. It can be affected by hormones. Are you on the pill? Are you on the coil? Are you on medication?
Are you depressed?
There's lots of things it can be affected by. So if you feel truly content in your relationship, then I would say it's unlikely there's something at a subconscious level.
I agree.
And if you were having great sex at the beginning, it's unlikely you're asexual. So if you eliminate... eliminate various things and
you've answered exactly how I would answer. I think that it's probably a relationship with yourself. It might be that it's anxiety, it might be stress from work, it might be a relationship with your own body, it might be the pill. I have to say, when I first met an ex-boyfriend, I wasn't on the pill, and then about 6 months in I went on the pill, and he said it was like going out with a different woman. Literally, microgynon just stole him from me. And I just cried all the time. I didn't want to have sex. I didn't want to be anywhere near him. I was really sad. So I do think that has a real impact. It could be the birth control that you're on. It could be that you're sad. It could be that there's some stuff that you're maybe not addressing. And that means you just feel a bit disconnected from your body, or you don't, you know, that you've got other things you're thinking about.
You don't say... Does she say how long it's been?
A few years, I think she said.
A few years. Okay, well, I would say a few years is long enough for you to investigate this properly like you would any other issue.
Yeah, and also, I would be wary the fact that you said that you haven't spoken to any of your friends about it. There's this culture that I think we have as young women that we all think we're having much more sex than we think we are. And I remember something happened in my friendships around my mid-20s where we stopped going, oh, hi, mate, yeah, got cystitis. Oh, yeah, had a shagathon last night for 10 hours.
Cool voice, darling.
And then we started saying, oh, no, me and my partner haven't had the time for however
long. It is an age thing, though, because it happens with boys as well. Like, my husband does not talk about, like... his sex life with his friends. I know they don't. I think it's because most of them are married.
But also, this is the great myth that I think men
are starting to realize. It's weird talking about your sex life with your, like, when you're younger and single, but like with your wife.
Yeah, but also, women talk about the details of sex, men don't. I've realized this more and more. Anyway, going off topic.
Dave's shaking his head.
That's true.
No, he's agreeing with you. Yeah. He's agreeing with you.
I think when men realize that, they really freak out.
So to wrap this up, what would be your...
I would talk to your friends about it, and I think you'd be surprised how many of them will probably have stories about their relationships that will help you out. Don't feel ashamed of it. It's completely normal. Relationships are, they're like a living organism, and they grow and move in different
ways.
There
is no normal relationship.
There's no normal.
There's no normal, full stop.
But I would like for you to be having sex with the person that you're in love with, so I'm sure that...
Especially if you wish you were.
Yeah, so I think maybe...
Start with the doctor and go from there.
Start with the doctor and go from there, because it might be something, as we said, chemical or hormonal.
People have gone to the doctor for weirder and worse things.
Do not feel embarrassed about this. Every person I know has experienced this at one point, so don't worry.
Thank you very much to everyone who wrote to us. If you would like to write into The High Low, you can email us, thehighlowshow@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at @thehighlowshow. Thank you to everyone who listened to episode 25. Thank you to Acast for letting us use your studio.
Thank you to Lauren Benstead for our funky jingle.
Thank you to Dave for stepping in whilst DJ CJ goes gardening. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. It helps other people find the podcast, and it also boosts us as well. Bye-bye.
Bye.